Out on the Street of Gods, everything felt different. There was a vague, unfocused tension on the air, and the crowding buildings felt grim and oppressive. Hawk and Fisher hurried along beside the God Squad, weapons drawn and at the ready. Toom took the point, striding confidently in the lead, his robe of sorcerer's black billowing impressively around his stocky frame. He was smiling calmly, his stance relaxed and at ease. Rowan hurried along at his side, stretching her legs to keep up with him. She carried a bulging satchel on one shoulder, and her face had taken on an uncomplicated expression of bulldog determination. Away from Toom's comfortable study, she looked stronger, more focused, almost elemental in her single-mindedness. Charles Buchan strolled along behind them, his long legs easily meeting their pace. He wore a brightly polished chainmail vest and a long sword on his left hip. He carried himself well, his bearing calm and controlled. His face was a smiling, pleasant mask, but his eyes were cold. Hawk kept a watchful eye on the squad as they hurried down the Street of Gods. Even with their practiced professionalism, he could all but see the tension rising off them. He started to wonder if he ought to feel more worried himself. After all, this was their territory. If they were worried, there was probably a damn good reason for it. The street itself seemed increasingly uneasy. There were fewer people around than previously, and they hurried on their way with heads bowed, eyes downcast. Two shadows, with nothing to cast them, tore at each other like maddened animals. A tall, angular building began to melt and run away like boiling wax, while the gargoyles on its guttering screamed in agony. Hawk increased his pace and moved in beside the sorcerer Toom.
Pardon me, Sir Toom, but if my partner and I are heading into a dangerous situation, I think we have a right to know what we're getting into.
Of course. You'll have to forgive us, Captain, but I'm afraid we're not used to working with strangers. Rowan and I both have the sight, the ability to see and sense things at a distance. Seems a long-standing rivalry between two religions has boiled over into open fighting on the street. The way things are, if we don't put a stop to it quickly, it'll develop into a full-blown riot, and the beings themselves may be tempted to get involved. Normally, things wouldn't get this bad this quickly, but with three dead gods and the murderer still at large, tempers are running short.
Wait a minute. If things are that serious, shouldn't we call in the SWAT team?
No, I don't think so. It's only a riot. We can handle it.
Famous last words.
Hawk gave Toom a hard look, but the sorcerer seemed perfectly serious.
All right, give me some background on this. You said two religions. Which religions?
They're based on two lesser beings. Neither of them especially powerful or important, but both with long-established followings. Dusk the Devourer is head of a no-frills nihilist cult. Everything is vile and awful. The world's going to be destroyed, and only the faithful will be saved and transported to a better world. I can't prove it, but I'm fairly sure Dusk itself is a manic depressive. The other being is the Chrysalis. It's a huge cocoon about 20 feet long. It's supposed to perform the occasional miracle, but I've never seen any. The Chrysalis followers believe that eventually the cocoon will open and the god within will emerge in all its glory to purge the world of evil, whether it wants to be purged or not. They've been watching the cocoon for over 400 years, but nothing's happened yet. Interestingly enough, each religion is the other's particular nemesis. Every god must have its devil, though I've never been sure why. Good business, I suppose. Anyway, normally the two groups of followers content themselves with blazing sermons, veiled insults in the street, and the occasional scuffle after the taverns close. But with things as they are, nothing's normal anymore. The Street of Gods is like a forest in a drought, waiting for a single spark to set everything alight.
Either that or they heard Fisher and I were coming and wanted to put on a good show to welcome us.
Fathead.
They heard the riot before they actually saw it. Hawk fell back a pace to walk beside Fisher. If they were going into a fight, he wanted someone at his back he could trust. The roar grew louder and more savage as they approached a sharp corner. According to the official maps, the Street of Gods was perfectly straight, but in this, as in so many other ways, the Street of Gods went its own way. They rounded the corner, and there was the riot spread out before them. 100 men and women milled back and forth across the street, mouths turned down in angry snarls, their eyes wild and furious. They were screaming and shouting and shaking their fists and glaring in all directions. Some had clubs or staves or lengths of steel chain, while others had bricks or stones. Already there was blood on the cobbles, and several people lay unmoving on the ground, trampled on unnoticed by the mob. The scent of violence was heavy on the air, ready to erupt at any moment. Hawk came to a halt well short of the mob and looked the situation over carefully. The setting couldn't have been worse. The street at this point was long and narrow, with only a few exits. Even if he could persuade the mob to break up and disperse, getting it separated into smaller, more manageable groups was going to be difficult. Breaking up a mob was one thing. Keeping them separated was what counted. There had to be somewhere for them to go. The size of the watching crowd worried him as well. There were hundreds of them, filling the street all around. Presumably, they followed other faiths and were happy at the chance to see two of their rivals knocking the hell out of each other. Even the street preachers had given up trying to spread the word and were busying themselves taking bets from the onlookers. Toom had come to a halt not far away and was watching the mob narrowly, lips pursed thoughtfully. Rowan was kneeling beside him, ferreting through her satchel. Hawk leaned over to take a look at what she had in there and then quickly retreated as she glared at him viciously. Buchan was standing close at hand, his arms folded across his mailed chest, staring majestically out over the mob. He looked as though he was only awaiting the word to step forward and generally beat heads together until everyone agreed to see reason. Hawk looked quickly at Fisher and was relieved to see she didn't appear too impressed. Fisher caught Hawk looking at her, realized why, and grinned broadly. Hawk looked away and pretended he hadn't noticed. He hefted his axe thoughtfully and watched the mood of the mob grow worse. This was the God Squad's territory, and he didn't want to interfere, but somebody had better do something soon, or there'd be brains spilled on the cobbles and a riot you'd need a small army to contain. Rowan drew a pair of slender copper rods from her satchel and plunged them into the ground. They sank easily into the solid stone as though it were nothing more than wet mud. The mystic then drew a protective circle around herself and Toom with blue chalk dust. Hawk frowned slightly as he realized he and Fisher and Buchan weren't included in the protection. Whatever Rowan and Toom were up to, he hoped they were careful to aim it in the right direction. The mystic and the sorcerer then paused for a technical discussion. Hawk moved over a little to stand beside Buchan, who was still silently studying the mob.
Who's winning, Sir Buchan?
Hard to tell. Strategically speaking, this is a mess. There's no cooperation. It's every man for himself and devil take the hindmost. Quite literally, I suppose, as far as they're concerned.
How do you tell the two sides apart?
Blue robes are chrysalis. Gray robes are dusk.
Fisher moved over to join them.
Are we gonna break this up or not? I can't just stand around and watch. It's bad for my reputation.
It's better not to butt in too early. Let them work off some of their bile on each other first.
You mean we're just supposed to stand by and let people die?
Fisher's face fell into an ominous scowl.
It's for the best.
Buchan looked at her and smiled slightly.
You're new to the street, my dear. We know what we're doing.
He realized Fisher was still glaring at him and stirred uncomfortably.
I suppose you've got a better way.
A riot's a riot. Hawk and I have handled a few in our time. You may be an expert in your territory, Sir Buchan, but we're not exactly amateurs in ours.
Well, if we can't handle this one, you may just get a chance to show us your expertise.
Toom and Rowan suddenly stood together and raised their arms in the stance of summoning. Rowan opened her mouth. The mystic chant cut through the din of the riot like a knife. Fights broke up, and people stopped shouting to sway unsteadily on their feet and clutch at their heads.
Mondala!
Toom's word of power, the crowd split suddenly in two. The gray and blue robes separated by some unseen force that left them in two confused crowds on opposite sides of the street. Hawk shifted uncomfortably from foot to foot and shook his head to clear it. The magic had only touched him briefly in passing, but he could appreciate how it must feel to those unfortunate enough to have suffered at full blast. Rowan stopped singing, and the Street of Gods was suddenly quiet. The two crowds took their hands away from their heads and looked uncertainly around them. They spotted the God Squad, and a low, rebellious murmur began, only to stop short as Buchan strode briskly forward into the middle of the street. Hawk and Fisher looked at each other and then strode quickly after him. Whatever was going to happen next, they were determined not to be left out of it. Buchan took up a position between the two crowds, looked left and right, and then beckoned imperiously. There was a pause. And then two men came forward, one from each side. Each man's robe was the color of his faction, one gray and one blue. But these were gorgeously styled and decorated. From their haughty expressions and bearing and the amount of jewelry they were wearing, Hawk decided these had to be the respective high priests of Dusk and the Chrysalis. They came to a halt before Buchan and bowed very slightly to him, each carefully ignoring the other.
All right, Who started it this time?
For a moment, Hawk thought the two priests were going to point at each other and shout, "He did!" like two children caught squabbling in the playground. But the moment passed. Both high priests drew themselves up to their full height and glared at Buchan.
Sir Field, Sir Stoner.
Buchan looked from the gray robe to the blue and back again.
I'm waiting for an answer.
Dusk the Devourer has been insulted.
Dusk insults the Chrysalis by its very existence.
Blasphemer!
Heretic!
Liar!
Fraud!
That's enough.
Buchan dropped his hand to the sword at his side. The two priests quieted reluctantly and turned their glares on Buchan rather than each other. Hawk frowned slightly. The high priests were tense, but not cowed. They had their followers watching, and neither of them was going to be the first to back down.
I want you both to go back to your people and get them off the street. You know the rules. Disturbances like this are bad for business.
To hell with your rules, and to hell with your squad! Cast your spells and be damned! The Lord Dusk will protect his children.
Your sorcerer and mystic can chant spells till they're blue in the face. You won't take us by surprise again. We have our own magic users.
Field nodded unflinchingly.
You're not in charge anymore, Buchan. The gods are dying, and you've done nothing. From now on, we defend ourselves.
Buchan just stood there, taken aback at being so openly defied, and the silence lengthened ominously. Hawk glanced at Fisher.
You take blue, I'll take gray.
Hawk stepped forward, axe in hand, to face the High Priest of Dusk the Devourer. Field looked at him warily, but held his ground. Hawk grinned unpleasantly.
I'm Hawk, captain in the City Guard. That's my partner, Captain Fisher. You may have heard of us. It's all true. Now get yourself and your people off the street, or I'll cut you off at the knees.
It was Field's turn to look taken aback, but he recovered more quickly than Buchan.
Lay a hand on me, God, and my followers will tear you apart.
Maybe, but you'll still be dead.
You're bluffing.
Try me.
Field met Hawk's unwavering gaze, and some of the confidence went out of him. A cold breeze touched the back of his neck as he realized the guard meant exactly what he said. He looked over at Stoner, who was staring at Fisher like a rat mesmerized by a snake. Field looked back at Hawk and nodded slowly. He turned away to face his followers, careful to make no sudden movements that might upset the guard.
My flock! The time is not yet right for direct confrontation. We must return to our homes and pray for guidance.
Brothers and sisters, it is not yet the time of retribution. Further prayer will show us the time and place.
The crowds stirred and reluctantly did as they were told. Field and Stoner turned back, sullen, to face Hawk and Fisher again.
Very nicely done. Now get the hell out of here. And if there's any more trouble, we'll know it's you and we'll come looking for you.
Right.
The two high priests left with what dignity they could muster, which wasn't much. Hawk looked at Buchan.
You were lucky.
All you have to do is separate out the leaders and break their authority.
Real fanatics would have died rather than give in.
But they weren't real fanatics, I could tell.
What would you have done if they had turned out to be the real thing?
Run like hell and scream for the SWAT team. I'm not crazy.
Right.
The Sorcerer Tomb led Hawk and Fisher down the Street of Gods, and the crowds parted before them to give them room. Curious eyes watched the guards pass, but no one wanted to get too close. Word of their arrival on the street preceded them. Hawk and Fisher nodded politely to the few brave souls who ventured a greeting and kept their eyes open for unfriendly faces. Their encounter with the high priests hadn't made them any friends. And besides, for no reason he could put his finger on, Hawk felt more than usually uneasy about his surroundings. The Street of Gods had changed since the last time he saw it. The buildings pressed more closely together, as though for comfort and support, and the occasional creatures and manifestations had a dangerous, openly threatening air. Even the street preachers seemed wilder, more intent on messages of destruction and damnation. The street had grown darker, colder, more turned in upon itself, as though it wasn't sure who it could trust anymore. Hawk looked at Fisher to see if she'd noticed the changes, and saw that her hand was back resting on the pommel of her sword. Fisher liked to be prepared. The last time they visited the Street of Gods, Hawk and Fisher were acting as bodyguards for the political candidate James Adamant, as he made the rounds of sympathetic beings, looking for support in the elections. Adamant was now Counselor Adamant, though, of course, that didn't necessarily prove anything, one way or the other. Though even then, the Street of Gods seemed a strange and eerie place with its creatures and illusions and uncertain reality, the street Hawk walked now seemed somehow more sour, more defensive. as though it was on its guard. Hawk frowned. Presumably, even gods could get scared with a god killer on the loose. He scowled and let his hand fall to the axe at his side. More and more, he was feeling very much out of his depth. He'd faced some strange things in his time, but his experience in Haven was for the most part with human killers, with their everyday schemes, passions, and hatreds. He knew how to handle them, but for better or worse, he was stuck with the God Squad now, until either he found the killer or his superiors relented. He'd just have to get used to the street, that was all. He'd seen worse in his time. A group of monks came striding down the Street of Gods, arms swinging with military precision. Their robes hung loosely about them, the cowls pulled forward to hide their faces. Toom moved to one side to let them pass, and Hawk and Fisher did the same. Anything could be dangerous on the Street of Gods, and it paid to be careful. The monks went by, looking neither left nor right. Toom waited until they'd passed, and then continued on his way, Hawk and Fisher following behind. They were on their way to look at the churches of the three murdered beings. Rowan wasn't with them because she wasn't feeling well. Apparently, she'd been quite ill recently and spent a lot of time in bed, dosing herself with her herbal remedies. Hawk just hoped it wasn't catching. And Buchan was off somewhere on business of his own. No one asked what. Buchan being Buchan, no one really wanted to know. Which left Toom to act as their guide. The first murder site was a huge, solid building right in the middle of the street. The walls were made of great stone blocks, each of them as big as a man. The church was three stories high, with narrow slits for windows. There was only one door, made of solid oak and reinforced with wide steel bands. Hawk studied the building thoughtfully as Toom fumbled with his key ring. The place looked more like a fortress than a church, which suggested this was a religion with enemies, in the church's mind, if nowhere else. Worship of the Dread Lord hadn't been an exactly popular religion. Human sacrifice wasn't banned on the Street of Gods, as long as it didn't endanger the tourists, but it was frowned on. Toom finally located the right key and unlocked the huge padlock affixed to the door. He pushed the door with his fingertips, and it swung smoothly open on its counterweights. Hawk studied the dark opening suspiciously.
There's no one in there, Captain Hawk. After the murder was discovered, I set up protective wards to keep out vandals and souvenir hunters. They're still in place. No one's been here since I left. Follow me, please.
Toom walked confidently into the gloom, and Hawk and Fisher followed him in, hands hovering over their weapons. A bright blue glow appeared around the sorcerer, pushing back the darkness and illuminating the hallway. The hall was grim and oppressive, without ornament or decoration of any kind. Toom allowed them a few moments to look around and then led them toward a door at the far end of the hall. This second door opened onto a rough wooden stairway leading down into darkness.
Watch the steps. Some of them are slippery, and there's no handrail.
They followed the stairs down into the darkness for a long time. Hawk tried to keep count, but he kept losing track. By the time they reached the bottom, Hawk realized they had to be uncomfortably far beneath the city, down in the bedrock itself. Toom gestured abruptly with his left hand, and the bright blue glow flared up, shedding its light over a larger area. Hawk and Fisher looked wonderingly about them. The stairs had brought them to a vast stone chamber, hundreds of feet in diameter. The walls were rough and unfinished, but the sharp edges left by the original cutting tools had been mostly smoothed over by air and moisture in the many years since the cavern had been hewn from the living rock. Stalactites and stalagmites hung down from the ceiling and jutted up from the cavern floor. There were pools of dark water, and thick white patches of fungi spattered across the walls. There were cobwebs everywhere, shrouding the walls and hanging in tatters between the stalactites and stalagmites. Fisher touched one strand with a fingertip, and it stretched unnaturally before it snapped. Fisher made a face and wiped her hand clean on her cloak. It was very quiet, and the slightest echo seemed to linger uncomfortably before fading away into whispers. In the middle of the cavern, the webbing had thickened and come together to form a huge hammock hanging suspended above their heads from the thickest stalactites. It was torn and tattered now, but there was enough left to suggest the immense size of the form that had once hung within it.
Gods come in all shapes and sizes. They can be human or inhuman, both and neither. People don't seem to care much, provided they're promised the right things.
You never did say what you believed in, Sir Tomb.
Tomb smiled.
I'm not sure I believe in anything anymore, my dear. Working on the Street of Gods will do that to you. It makes you doubt too many things. Or perhaps it just makes you cynical. We need gods, all of us. They offer hope and comfort and forgiveness. And most of all, they offer reassurance. We're all afraid of dying, afraid of going alone into the dark. And perhaps even more than that, we need to believe in something greater than ourselves. Something to give our lives meaning and purpose.
What happened to the body? I take it the being did have a body.
Oh yes, Captain Hawk. It's over there. What's left of it.
Tomb led them across the gloomy cavern and came to a stop before what Hawk had taken for an exceptionally large boulder. It turned out to be a huge pile of sharp-edged objects, dark and glazed, held together in one place by strands of webbing. It took Hawk a while to work out what he was looking at, but eventually some of the shapes took on sense and meaning, and his lip curled in disgust. Going by the size of the carapace segments and the many jointed legs, the Dread Lord had been more insect than anything else. The pile of broken pieces stood nearly 10 feet tall and was easily as broad. The being itself must have been huge. Hawk shivered involuntarily. He'd never liked insects.
Was it in pieces like this when you found it?
More or less. The pieces were strewn across the floor of the chamber. Whatever killed this being tore the body apart as though it were nothing but paper. Its followers tidied it up.
So the killer has to be immensely strong.
She thought for a moment, staring at the pile before her.
This dismembering, was it done while the being was still alive or after it was dead?
I don't know. I hadn't really thought about it. How can you tell?
By the amount of blood. It stops flowing after you're dead. So if there's not much blood splashed around a dismembered body, it's a safe enough bet the victim was dead at the time. You learn things like that in the North Side.
I see. Most interesting, but not much help here, I'm afraid. The Dread Lord didn't have any blood. Its body was hollow.
Hawk and Fisher looked at each other.
This case gets better all the time.
Do we have any clues as to the motive? Did the Dread Lord have any particular enemies or rivals? Someone who might profit by its death?
Tomb shook his head.
There was no feud or vendetta as far as we can tell. The Dread Lord hadn't been on the street long enough to acquire that kind of enemy.
All right, let's try something simpler. Do we know when the murder took place?
Sometime during the early hours of the morning, 9 days ago. The High Priest came down to consult with his god about whatever nihilists consider important and found his god scattered across the cavern floor.
Can we question him about it?
Not easily. The High Priest and all the Dread Lord's followers are dead. Suicide. That's nihilists for you.
Great. No witnesses to the murder, no clues at the scene of the crime, and no one left to question. I've only been on this case a few hours and already it's driving me crazy. Nothing in this damned case makes sense. I mean, how did the killer get down here? I assume the church was well guarded.
Oh yes. Over 100 armed guards, supplied by the Brotherhood of Steel. No one saw anything.
Oh, I hate this case.
This is the Street of Gods, Captain Fisher. Normal rules and logic don't apply here.
Hawk looked at the pile of broken and splintered chitin that had once been worshipped as a god. He shook his head slowly and turned his back on it.
We're not going to learn anything useful here. I'll call in the forensic sorcerers and see what they can turn up.
Tomb was shaking his head.
All right, what's wrong now?
I don't think the beings would allow that kind of investigative sorcery on their territory. The gods must have their mysteries.
Even though the sorcerers might come up with something to keep them alive?
Even then.
Damn. In that case, we'll just have to do it the hard way. Take us to the next murder site, Sir Tomb, and let's hope we can dig up something useful there.
At first glance, it was just an ordinary house. 2 stories, slate roof, good brickwork. Windows and brasswork had been recently cleaned. It looked as out of place on the Street of Gods as a lamb in a wolf pack. Tomb knocked politely on the plain wooden door. There was a long pause.
Are you sure this is the right place? This is the closest I've ever seen to archetypal merchant class housing. All it needs is a rococo boot scraper and a lion's head door knocker, and it'd be perfect. What kind of god would live here?
The Sundered Man. And he doesn't live here anymore. He was murdered 6 days ago. Show some respect, Captain, please.
They waited some more. People passed by on the Street of Gods, going about their business in the warm summer sun. But all of them seemed to have some kind of smile for the people waiting outside the tacky little two-up, two-down merchant's house. Fisher took to glaring indiscriminately at anyone who even looked in their direction.
Are you sure there's somebody in there?
There's a caretaker, Sister Anna. I contacted her earlier today, and she said she'd be here.
On the other side of the door, bolts were drawn back, and they turned to face the door again. It swung suddenly open, revealing a plain-faced, average-looking woman in her late 40s. She was dressed well, but not expensively, in a style that had last been fashionable a good 10 years ago. She looked tired and drawn and somehow defeated by life. She smiled briefly at Hawk and Fisher and bowed politely to Toom.
Good day, Sir Sorcerer, Captains. I'm sorry I took so long, but all the others have left now, and I have to do everything myself. Please, come in.
She stood back, and Toom led the two guards into the hall. It was just as narrow and gloomy as Hawk expected, with bare floorboards and plain wood paneling on the walls. But everything was neat and tidy, and the simple furniture glowed from recent polishing. Sister Anna shut the door and slid home 4 heavy bolts. She caught Hawk looking at her and smiled self-consciously.
Our god has been dead barely a week, and already the vultures are gathering on the street. If Sir Toom hadn't put protective wards round the house on his first visit, they'd have torn the place apart by now, searching for objects of power and whatever loot they could lay their hands on. Not that they'd have found much of either. We were never a rich or powerful order. We had our god and his teachings, and that was all. It was enough. As it is, the wards keep most of them away, and the locks and bolts take care of the rest. This way, please.
She led them into a pleasant little drawing room and saw them all comfortably seated before departing for the kitchen to get them some tea. Hawk slipped his hand inside his shirt and felt for the bone amulet that hung from his neck. It was still and quiet to his touch. If there was any magic left inside the house, it was so small the amulet couldn't detect it. Hawk took his hand away from the amulet and looked around the drawing room. It was comfortably appointed, but nothing special. Cups and saucers sat carefully laid out on the table, along with milk and sugar. He looked hard at Toom.
What the hell is going on here, Sir Sorcerer?
Toom smiled slightly.
You'll find all kinds on the Street of Gods, Captain Hawk. Allow me to tell you the story of the Sundered Man. It's really very interesting. His life, until his 24th year, was quiet, comfortable, and quite uninteresting to anyone save himself. He was a junior clerk in the shipping offices. A little dull, but good prospects. Then the miracle happened. For reasons we still don't understand, he took it into his head to visit the Street of Gods, and whilst there he started to perform wonders and speak prophecy. For 24 hours he walked the Street of Gods, wrapped in power and dispensing miracles. Then something happened. His followers called it the final miracle. He levitated into the air, smiled at something only he could see, and never moved again. He had somehow become sundered from time, frozen in a single moment of eternity, unmoving, unchanging, never aging. Nothing could reach him or harm him or affect him in any way. It was never a very big religion, but those who'd been with him on that day and saw his wonders and heard him preach proved very loyal. They believed their man had become more than human, a god who'd stepped outside of time to commune with realities beyond our own. One day he would return and share his knowledge with the faithful. That was 22 years ago. They waited all that time, and then somebody killed their god.
But why build a house like this on the Street of Gods? Why not a church or temple like everyone else?
This was his house, or as near as we could get to duplicating it. We built it around him, room by room. We wanted him to feel at home when he returned.
She put her tray down on the table, picked up the china teapot and silver tea strainer, and poured tea for all of them. She finally sat down facing them, and they all sipped their tea in silence for a while. Hawk studied her over his cup. There were deep lines in her face, and her eyes looked bruised and puffy, as though she'd been crying recently. She sat shoulders slumped with a polite, though unfocused, gaze. Delayed shock, thought Hawk. The longer you stave it off, the harder it finally hits. He looked at Toom and raised an eyebrow, but the sorcerer seemed content to leave the questioning to him.
When did you first discover your god was dead?
4 o'clock in the morning, 6 days ago. When he finally returned to us, one of our people was always with him so that he wouldn't be alone. Brother John was on duty. He went to sleep. He didn't know why. It wasn't like him. When Brother John awoke, the god was no longer standing by the altar we made for him. He was lying crumpled on the floor, a knife in his heart. The blood was everywhere. Brother John spread the alarm, but there was no trace of the killer. We still don't know how he got in or out.
Can we speak to this Brother John?
I'm afraid not. He took poison later that day. He wasn't the only one. We all went a little crazy for a while.
I understand.
No, you don't, Captain.
Sister Anna looked at him squarely.
For 22 years we waited, devoting our lives to the sundered man, only to find it was all a lie. He wasn't a god after all. Gods don't bleed and die. He was just a man. A man with power, perhaps, but nothing more. I'm the only one left now. The others are all gone. Some killed themselves. Some went home to the families they'd given up for their god. Some went to look for a new god to worship. Some went mad. They all left as the days passed and our god stayed dead.
For a while, nobody said anything.
Is the body still there?
Oh, yes. None of us wanted to move him. We didn't even want to touch him.
They found the sundered man lying on the floor, curled around the knife that killed him. Dried blood lay all around the body, but no sign of any struggle. Hawk knelt down beside the man. There was only the one wound, no cuts to the hands or arms to suggest he'd tried to fend off his attacker. It was a standard-looking knife hilt, the kind you could buy anywhere in Haven. The dead man's face was calm and peaceful. Hawk got to his feet again and shook his head slowly.
No, there's nothing here to help us. Nothing I can see, anyway. Sister Anna, do you have any objections to our calling in the forensic sorcerers?
No. Do as you wish, Captain. It really doesn't matter.
Why did you stay? All the others left, but you stayed. What keeps you here?
Sister Anna looked down at the body and smiled slightly.
I was there on the Street of Gods 22 years ago when it all began. I was just passing through, but he looked at me and smiled, and I stopped to hear him preach. He was magnificent. When he left, I went with him, and from that moment on, I was always at his side. After he was taken from us, sundered from time, I made this place my home and waited for him to come back to me. How could I leave him? It didn't matter to me whether he was a god or a man. I stayed because I loved him, and always have.
The Church of the Carmadine Stalker turned out to be a door in a wall. To one side of the door stood a pleasant little chapel of the Bright Lady, all flowers and vines and pastel colors. On the other side was an open, airy temple dedicated to the January Man. The door itself didn't look like much. It was 6 feet high and 3 feet wide, with peeling paint, splintering wood, and a large discolored steel padlock. It was the kind of door that, in Hawk's experience, usually fronted lockup warehouses down by the docks, specializing in the kinds of goods no one would publicly admit to wanting. He studied the door thoughtfully, aware that Toom was watching him and waiting for him to comment. Obviously, Toom expected him to get all upset again. He was damned if he'd give the sorcerer the satisfaction.
All right, it's a door. Do we knock or go straight in?
I'd better lead the way. The stalkers don't care for uninvited guests, with or without council authority.
Wait a minute. If the Carmadine Stalker has been murdered, why are his followers still hanging around here?
They're waiting for him to rise from the dead. With all due respect, Captain Fisher, Captain Hawk, I think we should keep this visit as short and to the point as possible. The Carmadine Stalker was an unpleasant god of an extremely unpleasant order. If his followers were to take exception to our presence, I'm not at all sure we'd get out of their lair alive.
Don't worry. We've been around. Takes a lot to upset us.
Toom looked at him for a moment and then turned to face the door. He gestured at the padlock and it snapped open. He pushed the door and it swung back, revealing a sickly green light. Toom stepped forward into it. Hawk started to follow and then stopped short as the smell hit him. It was a thick, choking smell of corruption and decay. The green light seemed to take on a more sinister aspect, reminding Hawk of the corpse fires that danced on recently built cairns. He braced himself and followed Tomb into the light. Fisher followed close behind, her hand at her sword belt. They found themselves in a long brick tunnel, slanting downwards, lit only by the eerie green light that came from everywhere and nowhere. The tunnel was only just tall enough for Fisher to stand upright, and no more than 3 or 4 feet wide. The brick walls were cracked and crumbling from age and neglect, and the floor was covered with pools of dark, scummy water. Mosses and fungi pockmarked the brickwork, and the smell of death and decay was almost overpowering. Far off in the distance, a bell tolled endlessly, like the slow, remorseless beating of a great, brazen heart.
What the hell is this place?
Fisher glared warily down the tunnel.
We're in the Stalker's domain, a pocket dimension, attached to our reality but not actually a part of it. Follow me, please.
Tomb led the two guards through an endless maze of narrow brick tunnels that twisted and turned and folded back upon themselves. The bell tolled on and on in the distance, but never seemed to draw any closer. Moisture dripped from the low ceiling and ran down the walls in sudden little streams. Hawk kept a wary eye on where they were going, but even so, the first priest caught him by surprise.
Oh.
The scrawny figure was sitting cross-legged in a niche set into the tunnel wall. He was old and shriveled, corpse pale and quite naked, bones pushed out against his taut flesh. His breathing was slow and shallow, and his eyes were closed. A length of discolored steel chain ran from a very heavy ring set in the wall to a great steel hook buried in the priest's shoulder. The tip of the hook poked out of the priest's flesh just below the armpit. From the way the puckered skin had healed around the sharp point, the hook had obviously been there a long time. Tomb and the two guards moved ahead quietly, trying to make as little noise as possible. But still, the priest's eyelids crawled open as they passed. Hawk froze in his tracks, his hand at his axe. The priest had no eyes, only empty sockets, but still his head turned to face Hawk. He smiled slowly, revealing filed, pointed teeth, and then his eyelids closed again. Hawk nodded to Fisher and Tomb, and they moved on, sitting unmoving in their niches in the walls. None of them stirred or spoke, but they all watched with empty eye sockets as the intruders passed. Finally, they came to a large chamber, empty save for a huge brass throne set in the center of the open space. On the throne sprawled what was left of the Carmadine Stalker. Hawk moved slowly forward, keeping a watchful eye on the other tunnels leading off from the chamber. He stopped before the throne and wrinkled his nose at the remains of the Stalker. The discolored bones were held together by rotting scraps of metal, and the grinning skull had been stripped almost clean of flesh. The Carmadine Stalker was an ugly sight in death, and probably looked worse when it was alive. It had to have been at least 8 feet tall, with a broad chest and a wide, flat head. The arms and legs were too long and much thicker than a man's. There were vicious talons on the hands and feet, and the grinning teeth were long and pointed. Hawk tried to imagine what that thing must have looked like in its time, and for a moment his breath caught in his throat.
The Stalker was a grisly kind of god.
Tomb spoke as though he was afraid of waking something.
Its religion was based around ritual sacrifice, mutilation, and cannibalism. Let's keep this short, Captain Hawk. This is a bad place to be. It's going to get even worse when the Stalkers realize their god isn't going to rise from the dead.
All right. Let's start at the beginning. How was the Stalker killed?
Apparently, it aged to death overnight, 3 days ago. According to city records, the Stalker was at least 700 years old. From the look of that body, I'd say a lot of those years finally caught up with it.
So, the killer was a magic user.
Either that, or someone with an object of power. Such things aren't exactly rare on the Street of Gods.
Hawk took a quick look around the empty chamber, but no obvious clues leapt to his gaze.
Is there anyone here we can talk to about how the killer got in and out?
No one here will talk to us, Captain. We're unbelievers.
Then let's get the hell out of here. This place looks more like a trap every minute.
Tomb nodded and headed quickly for the tunnel mouth that brought them there. Fisher followed close behind, sword in hand. Hawk backed out of the chamber, keeping a careful watch on the dead god all the way. He had a strong feeling that at any moment the tattered corpse might raise its bony head and look at him. He kept watching it until a bend in the tunnel cut off his view. Then he turned and hurried after Toom and Fisher. Toom led them confidently back through the maze of brick tunnels, then stopped suddenly and bit his lip. Hawk frowned. By his reckoning, they were barely halfway back to the door on the Street of Gods. Toom stood very still, his gaze vague and far away. Hawk looked quickly about him. The tunnel stretched off in both directions, silent and empty, bathed in the sickly light of the ubiquitous green glow.
Something's coming.
Hawk hefted his axe and Fisher drew her sword.
What kind of something?
A group of men. A large group. Maybe as many as 20. All of them armed. Apparently the Carmadine Stalker's followers don't want us to leave.
Toom shivered suddenly and his gaze cleared.
I may be wrong, but I think it's very likely they're planning on sacrificing us to their god in the hope it will help him return.
All right, you're the sorcerer. Do something.
It's not that simple.
Oh, I had a feeling he was going to say that.
There are things I can do, but in this dimension they take time to prepare. You'll just have to hold them off for a while.
Hawk and Fisher looked at each other.
Hold them off?
20 men?
All religious fanatics and armed to the teeth.
Here's a cake.
The two guards fell silent. In the darkness of one of the side tunnels, someone was moving. Whoever it was trying to be quiet, but even the faintest of sounds traveled clearly in the quiet of the tunnels. Hawk and Fisher stood side by side, weapons at the ready. Toom gave the tunnel a quick glance.
This tunnel.
The first of the stalkers came charging out of the side tunnel, and Hawk braced himself to meet him. The stalker was tall and wiry, with a wide grin and staring eyes. He wore a dark, flapping robe and carried a vicious-looking scimitar. He threw himself at Hawk, the curved blade reaching for the guard's throat. Hawk batted the sword aside easily and buried the axe in the stalker's face on the backswing. The stalker fell to his knees, blood coursing down his grinning face. The true believer crumpled to the floor as Hawk jerked the axe free. More stalkers came boiling out of the side tunnel, their eyes glaring wildly. Swords and axes gleamed in the eerie green light. Hawk and Fisher launched themselves at their attackers. The flood of stalkers stumbled to a sudden halt as Hawk and Fisher slammed into them. Hawk swung his axe in short, vicious arcs, and stalkers fell dead and dying to the floor. Fisher stamped and thrust at his side, warding off the few stalkers with reflexes fast enough to start their own attacks. Blood splashed the tunnel walls and collected in pools on the floor. The narrow tunnel meant that only a few of the stalkers could press their attack at one time, and Hawk and Fisher were more than a match for them. But even so, the fanatical hatred and fervor of the stalkers drove them forward over the bodies of the slain, and step by step, Hawk and Fisher were driven back down the tunnel. Toom retreated behind them, still lost in his muttering. The stalker before Fisher paused suddenly, his mouth gaping with surprise, and then his head exploded. Blood and brain spattered the tunnel roof and walls. Fisher jumped back, startled. Within the space of a few moments, the tunnel floor was littered with headless bodies. Hawk and Fisher lowered their weapons, looked at each other, and then turned to stare at Toom.
Sorry it took so long, but that kind of spell is rather tricky to work out. You have to be very careful where you put the decimal point.
He stopped suddenly, his head cocked to one side, listening to something only he could hear.
I think it might be wise to press on. There are more stalkers on their way. Rather more than I can handle, I'm afraid.
Then what the hell are we standing around here for? Move it!
He pushed Toom ahead of him, and the three of them ran swiftly through the brick tunnels, heading for the outside world. They hadn't gone far when they heard the sound of running feet behind them.
Come on! Come on!
Hawk and Fisher ran faster, urging Toom on. He guided them through the maze of tunnels with unwavering confidence. Suddenly, they were through the doorway and out on the Street of Gods, blinking dazedly in the bright summer sun. Toom turned to face the door and gestured sharply. The door disappeared, leaving a blank wall behind it.
That should hold them. Long enough for us to make ourselves scarce, anyway. I trust you found the visit useful.
Sure. Nothing like being chased by an army of murderous fanatics to give you a good workout.
Good. Because I'm afraid I have to leave you now. I do have other work to attend to, you know.
Toom produced a folded piece of paper from a hidden pocket and handed it to Hawk.
This is a list of beings who may agree to speak to you. It would help you to have an overview of what's happening on the Street of Gods at the moment. Beyond that, I'm afraid I really don't know what else to suggest. Tracking down murderers is a little outside my experience.
We'll cope. We're captains of the guard. We don't need our hands held. Right, Hawk?
Right.
I'm relieved to hear it. If you need me again, or any other member of the squad, just ask around. Someone will always know where we are. It's part of our job to have a high profile. Good day.
He bowed politely to them both, and then set off down the street at a pace obviously calculated to prevent any further discussion. Hawk looked at Fisher.
He knows something. Something he doesn't want us asking him about. I wonder what.
Hawk shrugged.
On the Street of Gods? That could cover a whole lot of territory.
Charles Buchan sat on the edge of his chair and waited impatiently for them to bring Annette to him. The Sisters of Joy were officially classed as a religion and had one of the largest establishments on the Street of Gods. But when you got right down to it, their lounge looked like nothing more than an upmarket brothel, which, in fact, wasn't really far from the mark. The Sisters of Joy were an old established religion, older than Haven itself, some said. It had branches all across the Low Kingdoms, to the impotent fury of equally old and established but more conservative religions. The sisters started out as temple prostitutes for a now-forgotten fertility goddess, probably not unlike the Bright Lady, and somehow evolved through their discovery of tantric magic into something far more powerful, not to mention sinister. Tantric magic is based on sex, or to be more exact, sexuality. Basically, the Sisters of Joy drained people's strength and vitality through sex, leeching at their very life force. The stolen energy gave them greatly extended lifespans and made them powerful magicians, but only so long as they maintained their energy level. They needed a lot of people to maintain their power and their long lives. But human nature being human nature, the sisters never lacked for visitors or victims, depending on one's point of view. Tantric magic wasn't strictly speaking part of the high magic at all, having its roots squarely in the older, less reputable wild magic, which was partly why most modern sorcerers would have nothing to do with it. The other reason was that women were a hell of a lot better at tantric magic than men, and the high magic was still largely a male province. So the high magic was socially acceptable, while tantric magic very definitely was not. The Sisters of Joy couldn't have cared less about that. They went their own way, as always. Their doors always open, day and night, to those who came to them in need or despair. The sisters offered care, comfort, affection, and in return bound all who came to them in a tightening web of emotional dependency and obligation. There were those who said the Sisters of Joy were addictive, and that those who fell under their influence became little more than slaves. No one said it too loudly or too publicly, of course. It wouldn't have been wise. Buchan got up out of his chair and paced. They would bring Annette to him soon. The lounge was almost indecently luxurious. A thick pile carpet covered the floor, and the walls had disappeared behind a profusion of paintings and hanging tapestries, most of them obscene. Perfumes sweetened the air. There were comfortable chairs, settees, love seats, delicately crafted tables bearing wines, spirits, cordials, and every kind of drug or potion. Nothing was forbidden here, and it was all free, to begin with. The Sisters of Joy amassed a considerable fortune over the many centuries, and they still received very generous donations from their grateful clients. No one ever mentioned blackmail, of course. That wouldn't have been wise either. With an effort, Buchan stopped himself from pacing. It was a sign of weakness, and he couldn't afford to be weak. He looked again at the brass-bound clock on the mantelpiece and frowned. He couldn't stay long, or Tomb and Rowan might wonder where he was. They might ask questions. So might Hawk and Fisher. He would have to be careful around the two guards. They had a reputation for sniffing out secrets and getting to the bottom of things. Buchan wore disguises when he made his visits to the Sisters of Joy, but no disguise was perfect, especially on the Street of Gods. Still, only the quality knew for sure of his connection with the sisters, and they didn't know as much as they thought they did. When one got right down to it, the chances of the city aristocracy deigning to discuss such matters with the likes of Hawk and Fisher were pretty damned remote. The quality wouldn't discuss one of their own with outsiders. even if they had disowned him. He smiled slightly. It wasn't that long ago he'd been an important figure in the Quality, a member in good standing and much in demand. No one cared about his reputation then. It just gave them something juicy to gossip about. The Quality loved their gossip. But even the most sybaritic, most debauched member of the Quality drew the line at his associating with the Sisters of Joy. The Sisters went beyond the pale, utterly forbidden. First his friends talked to him about it, and then his enemies. His family forbade him to visit the Sisters on pain of disowning him. But he couldn't stay away, and he wouldn't tell them why, so in the end, the Quality turned their backs on him. His family cut him off without a penny. He didn't care, not really. He had a new life in the God Squad, and he had his Annette. The door opened, and she came in. His breath caught in his throat, as it always did, and he stood there for a long moment, just drinking in the sight of her. She was tall, slender, graceful and lovely. Long blonde hair curled down around her shoulders, and her eyes sparkled as blue as his own. She smiled at him, the special smile she saved for him and him alone, and ran forward into his waiting arms. Toom slowly climbed the stairs to Rowan's room, a silver tray floating on the air beside him, bearing a cup of steaming tea.
What can be the matter with Rowan? She's been ill on and off for months now.
The mystic wouldn't let anyone call in a doctor to see her. She didn't believe in doctors, preferring to dose herself with her own foul mixtures. Toom didn't know what went into them, but every time Rowan prepared a fresh batch in the kitchen, the cook threatened to quit. Having smelt the fumes himself on more than one occasion, Toom didn't blame her. Any stronger, and the smell could knock down walls. Toom's mouth twitched, but he was too worried to smile. Rowan had been taking her vial doses for weeks, and she was still no better. If her condition didn't improve soon, he'd bring in a doctor, no matter what she said. He couldn't stand to see her looking so drawn and tired. He moved quietly along the landing and stopped outside Rowan's door. There was no reply. He glared at the tea tray when it showed signs of wavering. He looked around vaguely as he waited. Rowan rarely answered the first few knocks. She liked her privacy, and often she didn't care for company. Rowan had never been what one might call sociable. Toom shifted his weight from one foot to the other. The house seemed very quiet. Buchan was out, and it was the servants' day off. Toom had been a member of the God Squad for almost 11 years now. He knew the house and its moods well. Of late, however, the quiet seemed to have an almost sinister nature. A quiet of unspoken words and too many secrets. Of course, the house was used to secrets. No one came to the God Squad with an entirely clean past, which was probably why so few of them stayed long. It wasn't everyone who could cope with the eccentric realities of the Street of Gods. Toom saw many warriors and mystics come and go down the years. He hoped Rowan would stay. She was special.
Rowan, it's me, Toom. I thought you might like a nice cup of tea. Can I come in?
There was still no reply. He entered quietly, the tea tray floating uncertainly behind him. Rowan was fast asleep, looking small and helpless and worrisomely frail in the oversized bed. She stirred slowly without waking and then settled again. She'd disarrayed the bedclothes in her sleep like a fretful child, and Toom moved quietly forward to straighten them. He stood back, looked around the room, and then looked at Rowan again. She seemed to be sleeping peacefully now. There didn't seem to be anything else he could do. There was no reason for him to stay. He sat down on the chair beside the bed. The room was the same featureless square as his own, but she'd done more to personalize hers in the short time she'd been there than he had in all of his 11 years. There were oil paintings on the walls that she'd executed herself. They showed promise. A cuddly toy with a stitched-on smile lay on the floor beside the bed. Rowan liked to take it to bed with her when the others were away on cases and she was left alone in the house at night. Toom understood that. There are times we all need something to cling to in the night. The rug on the floor was a new addition. Tomb spent a whole afternoon in the markets with her, trying to find one just the right shade to complement the bedclothes. She stirred again in her sleep, and Tomb looked at her quickly, but she didn't waken. He sat and watched her for a while. He liked to watch her. He could quite happily have sat where he was all day and all night, watching over her, caring for her, loving her. He smiled slightly. He never used the word love, except in his thoughts. He told her once how he felt about her, after an hour or so of talking around the subject while he worked up his nerve. The best he could say of the outcome was that at least she hadn't laughed at him. She just told him she didn't care for him and seemed to think that was the end of it. Tomb smiled tiredly. If only it was that easy. He hadn't asked to fall in love with her. She wasn't especially bright or pretty, but she owned his heart and always would, and there wasn't a thing he could do about it. Reluctantly, he got to his feet. Rowan could wake up any time now, and he'd better not be here when she did. He didn't want to upset her. He left the room quietly. He made his way back down the stairs, frowning slightly as he tried to work out what he ought to do next. There was a hell of a lot of paperwork that needed seeing to, but then there always was. It could wait a little longer. He supposed he could take a walk down the street, talk to people, get a feel of how the street was reacting to Hawk and Fisher's arrival. Or he could go to see La Belle Inconnue. Tomb stopped at the bottom of the stairs. He couldn't go now. It was far too dangerous with Hawk and Fisher out on the street. They wouldn't understand. But he couldn't stay away, either. It was already too long since his last visit. He glanced back up the stairs. Rowan would be all right. The protective wards around the house would make sure she wasn't disturbed. And if she wanted anything, she only had to call and Tomb would hear her wherever he was. She knew that. He hurried down the hall, took his cloak from the rack, and swung it around his shoulders. He pulled the hood forward, adjusting it so its shadow covered his face. He could have used a disguise spell, but there were too many places on the street where magic couldn't be relied on, and this was too important to take unnecessary risks. The sorcerer Tomb opened the door with a wave of his hand and went out onto the Street of Gods. Hawk and Fisher slogged up and down the Street of Gods, working their way through the list of names Tomb gave them. Hours passed, but the sun overhead didn't move. It was noon on the Street of Gods, and had been for several days. Robed acolytes hurried past them on unknown missions, heads bowed to show respect and humility, and to avoid having to see churches and temples more splendid than their own. The street preachers still worked themselves into hysterical rages and set fire to each other, but no one paid much attention, except the tourists. Hawk and Fisher tramped grimly back and forth, getting what information they could from the beings Tomb named as potentially helpful, and doing their best to ignore the wonders and terrors that thronged the street. The Night People were an old necromantic sect, not as well supported as they had once been. Their high priest met Hawk and Fisher in the ossuary, the Cathedral of Bone. Intricate patterns of polished bones formed the floor, walls, and ceilings of the ossuary. Some were recognizably human, others were so large and grotesque that Hawk preferred not to think about where they might have come from originally. The air smelled of musk and cinnamon, and strange lights flickered in far-off windows. All the time they were there, Hawk had a strong feeling they were being watched, as though something awful and implacable lurked just out of sight, waiting patiently for him to drop his guard. He kept his hand near his axe. The Night People were blind, their eyelids stitched together, but they all moved and spoke with an eerie certainty that bordered on the unnerving. Hawk did his best to ignore the uneasy prickling on the back of his neck.
"We would like to see your god."
The high priest shook his head slowly.
"Only the faithful may see God. The sight is so glorious it sears the eyes of all who see."
Hawk tried to press the matter further, but the high priest would not be moved.
"You may not see the One of Glory. I will submit your questions for response. Neither may you question the faithful. No one knows anything that might help you."
"But..."
"No one knows anything of the god killings.
What
can they..." "No one knows anything about anything beyond that which they know."
Hawk and Fisher went from church to temple to meeting house, and the message was always the same. The hanged man was polite but unhelpful. Sweet Corruption wasn't even polite. The Lord of the New Flesh refused even to see them. And so it went the length of the street, until finally they came to the Legion of the Primeval. The Legion's church was a tall building of spires and domes and crenellated towers. There were magnificent stained glass windows and flags and banners in a dozen different hues. Some other time, Hawk might have been impressed, but as it was, all he could think of was his aching feet. It had been a long day. The Legion priests, however, were frankly disturbing. Each and every one had a staring alien eye embedded somewhere in his flesh. It was large and crimson with a dark split pupil, but it blazed unblinkingly from forehead, chest, or hand. In a few cases, it had displaced one of the priest's original eyes, and it bulged uncomfortably in the too small socket, glaring balefully at the world. Legend had it that the Legion was the means whereby an ancient being from another plane of existence was able to observe the world of men. The High Priest seemed happy to talk to Hawk and Fisher, but could do little to help them. With three beings murdered in a matter of weeks, gossip ran wild on the Street of Gods. But no one knew anything for sure. People were scared. So were some of the beings. Everyone was looking for a villain, someone to blame and strike back at. No one mentioned God War yet, but everyone thought about it. Hawk and Fisher talked with the High Priest for some time, trying to avoid staring at the great crimson eye that glared unblinkingly from his forehead. Nothing much came of it until right at the end, when the High Priest suddenly leaned forward on his throne and fixed Hawk with his unnerving stare.
Tell me, Captain, have you ever heard of the Hellfire Club?
No, can't say that I have.
Hawk looked at Fisher and she shook her head slightly. The High Priest leaned back on his throne, his expression unreadable beneath the glowing third eye.
Ask Charles Buchan, Captain. He knows. Now, thank you for coming. I must return to my duties.
In a matter of minutes, the two guards were back on the street again, not much wiser than when they'd started. It was still midday, and the air was uncomfortably warm. Hawk and Fisher decided simultaneously that what they really needed to help put things in perspective was a stiff drink, or two. Accordingly, they made their way to the nearest temple dedicated to John Barleycorn and ordered a ceremonial libation in tall glasses. They took their drinks and settled into a private booth at the back of the temple where the lights were comfortably dim. Hawk stretched out his legs and propped his aching feet on a nearby chair. Fisher took off her boots and massaged her toes. Some moments were just too precious to interrupt, but eventually they turned their attention to their drinks and the matter at hand.
All right, let's run through what we've got. Three beings are dead. Since they are dead, I think it's safe to call them beings rather than gods. The Dread Lord died 9 days ago. His body had been torn apart. The Sundered Man was stabbed to death 6 days ago. And the Karmadine Stalker apparently aged to death 3 days ago. Doesn't take a genius to spot the pattern, does it?
A murder every 3 days. With another due sometime today, if the pattern continues.
Right. And there's nothing we can do to prevent it. We don't have enough information, and no one will talk to us.
Why should the Street of Gods be any different from the rest of Haven?
Anywhere else, I could persuade someone to talk to us, but the Mystic was right. Strong-arm tactics aren't going to work here. If I start shoving my axe in a being's face, I'll probably end up snapping at flies on a lily pad. Intimidation is very definitely out. That just leaves diplomacy.
I'll leave that to you. I don't have the knack.
I had noticed. What do we have on the killer? He comes and goes at will, even when the temples are heavily guarded by well-armed fanatics. Which means he's either invisible, which means a sorcerer, or a master of disguise. Or it's someone they expect to see. Someone they don't recognize as a threat. Each being died in a different way, and as far as we can tell, none of them had anything in common. So how does the killer choose his victims? At random? Damn it, I don't even know where to start on this case, Isabel.
Don't give up so easily. Look at it this way. The killer has to be immensely strong and able to pass unseen. So how about a supernatural killer, like a vampire? He could get past the guards by shape-shifting into a bat or a mist, and he'd be more than strong enough to tear apart the Dreadlord. It would even explain why all the killings took place in the early hours of the morning.
It's a possibility, Isabel. But I can't believe the beings wouldn't have protective wards specifically designed to keep out supernatural vermin like that. Everybody else does that can afford them. No, Isabel, I think magic is the key here.
You mean a rogue sorcerer?
Maybe. An invisibility spell would get him past the wards and the guards. And then he could use magic to blast apart the Dread Lord and age the Stalker to death.
But then why use a knife on the Sundered Man?
To be misleading?
Ugh, misdirection gives me a headache. Wait a minute, though.
Fisher took a long drink from her glass and frowned hard as she concentrated.
Turn it around. You can also see the killings being linked by a lack of magic. The wards couldn't keep the killer out. The magic keeping the Stalker alive failed. So did the magic keeping the Sundered Man out of time. Maybe it was only magic that was holding the Dread Lord together. He was hollow, remember? So maybe what we're looking for is a sorcerer, or a man with an object of power that can dispel magic and leave the beings vulnerable.
An object of power that dispels magic. The Exorcist Stone.
Oh, hell. One of the God Squad as a God Killer? Come on, Hawk.
They're the only ones that can use the Exorcist Stone.
But the Council put a compulsion on them to prevent them from misusing it.
If this was an easy case, they wouldn't need us to solve it. It has to be one of the God Squad, Isabel. It's the only theory that fits all the facts. The killer must have found some way to bypass the compulsion.
We don't dare accuse any of them without a hell of a lot of proof. These people have friends in high places. Sometimes, literally. Damn it, Hawk. We're supposed to be working with these people. How can we keep something like this from them?
Very carefully. Whichever one of them is the killer has already destroyed three beings. I don't think they'd hesitate to kill a couple of guards who were getting too close to the truth.
They sat in silence for a while.
So, what are we going
to
do?
Take things one step at a time. To start with, I think we'll talk to Charles Buchan and see what he knows about the Hellfire Club, whatever that is.
He was the only one of the God Squad to be named during our investigation.
Yes, that's interesting, but perhaps just a little too obvious. Unless we're supposed to think that it's obvious.
Oh.
Fisher reached for her glass again.